morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road, and we are streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We are podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you feel like it, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can also find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later on in the show, we're going to be speaking with Billy Blair, who is with the Santa Fe Community Foundation. Right now, I would like to welcome artist James Drake. He will be speaking tonight at the Santa Fe Art Institute at 6 o'clock at Tipton Hall. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
So you will be talking about your work, and your work spans many different genres. Why don't we start with what you're doing now? What are you working on right now?
I'm doing a lot of drawings now, but drawing was always one of my main interests, and I always feel like that drawing, that all of the other work, whether it was sculpture or, I've never done painting, but whether it was sculpture or video or anything like that, always began with drawing.
And so, it's funny, I was looking through your book and looking at the drawings and sculptures and some of the other images in this very beautiful monograph that has come out about you, and thinking, and I know that I shouldn't, that this isn't a definitive statement. I was thinking, real artists all know really how to draw. I mean, draftsmanship is at the base of everything, and I find it interesting that you just basically said that.
Well, I think they're interested in drawing. That's the, I don't know if they all know how to draw. I think everybody can put down their thoughts in drawing.
Yeah, all people who can draw think that.
Everyone can draw if they want to.
Where did you start? You started as probably a very young person drawing.
Oh, yeah, I did. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's the typical tale of someone sitting around drawing and expressing themselves. And I wasn't good at sports, and I wasn't good at too many other things, but I like to draw and put things together. So that's what I did.
And what kind of subjects were you interested in first, and how have those continued or not continued?
Well, I think probably like all kids, you draw the things that are around you, or you draw cartoons, and you draw cars, and you draw people, just the normal things that probably, I don't draw cars necessarily, but the things that still interest you. So I think that never changes. It just becomes your view of the world is a little bit more expansive.
One of the things, now, one of your subjects is animals.
Well, not really. I don't say I draw animals or I make animals. They tie into certain things, and they might be a part of certain things, or they might be a metaphor for certain things, but I don't consider myself someone that draws animals per se, even though they appear in a lot of the work.
So it's not in the Audubon sense of drawing the
birds. I think Audubon was great. I love Audubon, but no.
But instead, they appear almost as human characters. Is that right?
Sometimes, and sometimes they are what they are.
So what are some of the themes that you're exploring right now?
Well, right now, I'm still working on a project I call Tongue-Cut Sparrows, which dealt with an invented sign language in different prison jails throughout the U.S. and in foreign countries where sign language was invented by the inmates to communicate with people not inside, well, inside, but mostly outside of the jail, so they didn't have to go through the bureaucracy of going in and being searched and going through metal detectors and that type of thing. So I've been working on that project for about 15 years. So I just finished another piece in that series.
Say more about that sign language. How does it work?
Well, it was and it's not based on the hearing impaired. It was invented. And now, I know some of the, you know, a lot of the hand gestures are just symbols, and sometimes they spell out if it's a difficult image they're trying to translate into a sign language. And so people on the inside of a jail or prison can look outside of a window and see their loved ones or their brothers or sisters or whoever signing up to them. So it's basically a fairly new, I would say, form of communication and a different form of communication.
How did it arise?
Well, I saw people doing it, and basically on the border, the El Paso-Juarez border. And so I asked some friends of mine what was going on, and they told me. So I befriended some of the people, and then over time I took photographs, and then we talked, and then I made videos and a book and drawings and all kinds of stuff.
When you're working on a project like that, how do you get to know people? Presumably there is a whole process of earning people's trust and respect.
Absolutely. That's one of the big things about it. And you have to be really careful about that, that you're not intruding on anyone's space or even their culture or personal life. I think that's a real important attitude that you have to take. And by attitude, I mean not have an attitude. The first, you need an introduction. At least I had an introduction from a person, a friend of mine, and then it just developed from there. Also, I paid everybody, so that was sort of an incentive. So when we were talking or they would show up and do signing, I would pay them and photograph and we would talk and so forth. So it developed. Like most relationships, you know, it develops.
Right. So I can see this whole thing of using it to communicate with people. If you're in jail, using something to communicate with people who are outside the windows, how is it used in other contexts, that sign language?
Well, it's used on the inside as well. You've probably seen, you know. But mainly that is the main way that it's used.
And is it a secret from the authorities who don't know that language?
Yeah, but then they learn it as well. The whole idea was that you're communicating with someone and you're talking about certain things that you don't want either other people to know or the authorities to know or even the people on the street to know. But eventually everybody picks up on it.
And then the language probably evolves to new signs that they don't understand.
Yeah, exactly. Well, yeah, I think so. I'm not sure about that. But there are some universal signs.
When you're working with communities that are not generally inside maybe the art world, so to speak, that you move in, do you bring them in? In other words, they become part of a project that happens in galleries and so on.
Absolutely, and I even consider these things collaborative efforts. And I think even the gaining of trust of someone to be able to photograph them or to make a drawing or whatever, because I was an artist, that was not as threatening, say, if I'd been an accountant. And I don't have anything against accountants.
Right.
I'm just saying it wasn't as threatening, and it seemed to be more open to the people that I was involved with.
But there are so many amazing prison artists, too.
Yeah, there are a lot. There's some. You know, it's like anything else. You know, there's some very interesting ones, and there's some, I'm interested in prison art, but not particularly.
We're talking to artist James Drake, who is speaking tonight at the Santa Fe Art Institute at Tipton Hall here in Santa Fe. You've also done work with making images of women, prostitutes.
All of this was developed by living on the border. And my wife and I, we were members of an organization called FEMAP, which helped people that were distressed along the border. And distress could be children that were orphaned, or children that were abandoned, or people with people that had abuse problems or whatever along the U.S.-Mexican border. And so through my involvement and my wife's involvement with that, I became interested in certain areas of the people that were at more risk than others, and some of those happened to be prostitutes and transvestites and so forth. So I did an entire project based on that.
When you were working with them, again, there you are working with prisoners, you're working with prostitutes. Did you pay them also? I mean,
sure,
you paid them for their time?
Absolutely.
And
of course.
Did you pay the same amount that a customer would have paid?
I don't know. I never ask there's some things I think are off limits, and I wasn't interested in actually the way they made their money, whether it was through prostitution or whatever. A lot of the people that I dealt with had, for lack of a better term, they had day jobs. Some were nurses or something like that, but they were still, then at night they would go to bars and so forth. And I just offered a certain amount of money. And usually that would be, okay, if you show up and talk to her, I'll give you $50 or something like that. So that was it wasn't based on their going rate, per se. Because I wasn't as interested in the sexual aspect of it as much as I was their lives and how, from coming up from the interior of Mexico, how that affected them and how they perceived the border. That was more of what I was interested in.
Those are stories that people tell. Do those stories come out in your work, or do people have to kind of reinvent it themselves by looking at the images?
Well, I think probably both. Hopefully, you give clues, and just by the looking at some of the work, there's probably, you realize these are people that you would meet, in your everyday job or your everyday activity, whatever you're involved with. But, to me, it's all art. Or hopefully, it's art. So that it's it'll be a little bit, my involvement and then the people that I'm collaborating with, their involvement and the viewers' involvement.
You made some videos
I made my first video in 1979.
Of these women, for example.
No, that was a completely different video. But I did do a video of the women, and I did a video of. I have actually two videos of the people signing. I'm actually going to show that at another venue here in Santa Fe in October. I guess it's okay. It's Santa Fe, so in a video show, so.
Let's talk about your sculptural work, some of which graces the front cover of this beautiful book, which is just simply called James Drake, which has come out with the University of Texas Press.
University of Texas Press, yes.
You're a draftsman, and then you make these metal sculptures of all sorts of subjects. How did you start going in that direction?
Well, I was always interested in making things. It goes back to... I think I mentioned that earlier when I was a kid. I made models. I sat around and made airplane models and boat models, and I was always building things and putting things together. So actually, to me, this is the same thing, only I'm a lot older.
It's funny. With visual art, there is always, to me, this whole question of what is the story behind it. When you're talking about the sign language, when you're talking about distressed people on the border, there are stories that are implicit in it. Sometimes in sculpture and drawing, there are. Sometimes there aren't. There are sometimes just simply the things themselves.
Oh, yeah, sure. Absolutely. It just, whatever you're involved with and whatever you're making. Mine, for lack of a better term, some people don't like this term. There's a lot of narrative, I suppose, in it. And I guess it does tell a story, and I even like that it tells a story.
What will you be talking about tonight?
It's an interest because I don't have a particular title for the talk. It's in a series of talks, and different artists have given talks, and I think the entire series is called, I believe, Memory, Shadow and Light. But I know memory is a part of it. So that was very interesting to me. Because we all think of memory. Probably everyone every day says the phrase, I remember, or I remember. And so I kept thinking, that's an interesting, I want to remember. So most of the things that I'm going to show and talk about, hopefully they're my memory. Hopefully all of the memories interconnect by either the imagery that's shown, they might interconnect by some of the animals, or they might connect through communication, because the prison signing basically was dealing with communication. So I even did a new drawing based on memory, my first memory that I can ever recall.
What was that?
Well, we were living in Central America, my family, everybody, in Guatemala City. And I was a real young kid, probably 3 or 4. And I would go to the markets with my grandmother. And then I was completely fluent in Spanish, and it was my first language, actually. And so I would translate for my grandmother when we would go to the market, and she would buy vegetables and so forth. And I remember in the market, they always had iguanas, a lot of them. As I remember, hanging from the ceiling. And that is my absolute first memory, and it all the smells of vegetables and the meat and the floor always seem to be damp and wet, maybe from cleaning and washing off the different stands and so forth. But the main memory was these iguanas hanging from the ceiling. Well, they'd tied to, you know, to different wooden structures in the ceiling, and they were dead, of course, as I recall. But that's and they were selling them. So that was my first memory. So I did a whole drawing based on that. Other people, I'm sure, have, you know, if you think about it, maybe. I think it's an interesting concept. What is your first memory, and then?
And sometimes, and whether that memory is real or whether it's a, like, 10th generation memory, you remembering the memory of, you know.
Memory, I think, is a real interesting concept in that sense, because probably my memory could be a little faded even. You know, maybe they weren't tied to the rafters of the building. Maybe it wasn't damp. Maybe it was, but that's what my memory has recorded.
Yeah, or maybe it's conflated with a couple of other
exactly,
things that
happened. Exactly, or maybe exactly in the same day or the same year or whatever, but that's what I remember.
And what's interesting about drawings or any kind of artwork that come from that place is that there's a very vivid resonance to it, and you can put so much into it because it comes from some sort of deep, early, primal place in your own
exactly.
soul.
Yeah, exactly. I think so. Yeah, that's so. It's you know, it was important to me, but the other reason for doing the drawing is because everybody obviously has memories, and their memory is just as important to my memory. So it was sort of one of those jumping off points of not necessarily asking someone else what's your memory, but I'm sure there'll be people that will. When I say that, they'll probably, or look at the drawing, they'll go, well, let's see what my first memory was. Maybe they've done it already, I don't know.
When I was looking through your book, I was thinking about, there's such an interesting combination of real kind of sensuality and that sense of beauty and physicality and things you want to, like looking at your sculptures, I don't know about everybody else, but one wants to touch them.
Well, the museums hate to hear this, but I like for them to be touched. And I've done a lot of rooms where they're made of steel and they're enclosed rooms. And they're fairly large, most of them. They're 16 feet by 12 feet or 16 feet, you know, by 18 or 20 feet that you actually walk into. So you're surrounded by this metal environment. And there are objects in there that are meant to be touched, but of course museums don't want you to ever touch anything. And one of them, you're supposed to sit down in the chair because then you get a different perspective and a different view, and you're in a different context from even though you're in the room from standing up, and that's all part of it for me.
And then there are works, perhaps like the works on the that you did on the border, that have so much narrative content to them that they maybe go over into the area of what people might call political art.
Yeah, I think there's definitely.
How do you see? I mean, do people call you that? Is that a?
Well, I guess they probably have. I don't. You know, a lot of artists probably will disagree. I don't consider myself a political artist per se, even though there's lots of. Politics, and I don't like that word politics, involved. I mean, there has to be, at least because a lot of the work I do has revolved around living on the border, the U.S.-Mexican border, and that's because of my relationship with Mexico, and I worked in Mexico, and living in Central America, and that whole thing.
The work that we were just starting to talk at the beginning of the program about work involving animals, and I remember, I think you must have shown these some years ago
It was at Site Santa Fe in 2005. The show was called City of Tells.
Right.
I had a huge drawing. It was 12 feet by 32 feet, and all these different people, family members, friends, and historical figures were all gathered around this banquet table.
What does the title City of Tells mean?
Well, a tell basically is, I'm not a gambler, but a tell in gambling's parlance, I suppose, well, I don't suppose, is you can get an advantage when you're playing, say, poker, if you know someone's tell. And that can be you know, very, very, very subtle. And I've heard people say, oh, you know, they might touch their wrists sometimes and be totally unaware of it if they're under stress or that they have good or bad cards or whatever.
So if they have good cards, they will inadvertently make some signal,
it's a tell,
which is called a tell.
Which is called a tell. So my whole point was that then we have all of these people gathered around this very extravagant banquet table, and they all have tells. And that's when I drew the thing, that was my main interest, was exposing their particular tell.
It's funny, it's interesting. There's one particular image that I'm looking at right now, which I wish I could hold up to the microphone and show to our radio listeners. But it's very funny when you see in a smile, whether it's real or whether it's entirely fake, and I don't know what it is about that facial expression that you can tell that it's phony, but it's phony.
Well, could be, could not. I don't, you know, that's your interpretation.
Right. And then these animals at the banquet table, it's sort of like, I was thinking casting pearls before swine, but in this case, gourmet food.
Well, then I thought, okay, I have people gathered around this banquet table. What I'll do then is I'll set up a banquet table out in the, and actually I did this in the Big Ben area. And all these feral pigs came, and I set up the banquet table with real food and, you know, the whole thing, just like you would for a human feast. And then set up video cameras, leave the area, and then I would come back, you know, 5-6 hours. Well, I had to because the tape was running out or the battery was running low. And these animals, different animals, would come to this table. And
so did you actually draw images from your video?
Yes.
Oh, that's so interesting.
Yeah, I use video a lot as sort of my the basis of a lot of the drawings. In fact, a lot.
And so, in a way, I've always wondered this, actually. Maybe you can tell me this as an artist, whether you can capture on paper through drawing something in a different way when it comes from a stop-action photograph or video than when you try to stop that action in your mind and draw a fleeting moment.
Yeah, I think so. Sure, I think so. Yeah, I think so, definitely. But it's for me, it was source material, where I suppose it might be just, you know, maybe a lot of people, they do a storyboard or a drawing or a sketch, and then they do a video. I think that's how movies are made, from storyboards. Well, mine is just the opposite. And that wasn't intentional. It just happened. I took the video and then made drawings, and I still do that.
There's a series.
See, those are some of the signing.
Well, that's, yeah, this series of signing, they're very close up on the hands of these people, to where they almost become abstract.
Well, that was what was important to me, was their hands and the signing and the gestures they were making with their hands, not the physicality of what they looked like.
When you learned that sign language, did you then start?
I haven't learned it. Really.
You haven't? So
no.
You don't know what all these things mean?
I mean, I know what some of them mean, but not all of them. I mean, I wasn't privy to, and they didn't want me to know everything, but I obviously know some of it.
Did you use it with them? Did you then become a person who was using this sign language?
No, I was too embarrassed to do it. I didn't feel comfortable doing that, because I don't think it was it's not my way of communicating, and I think that it, for me to probably do that, would have been, I don't know, it just wouldn't have been right.
Intrusive somehow?
Exactly.
We're talking to James Drake, artist, who will be tonight at the Santa Fe Art Institute-sponsored lecture at Tipton Hall, which is on the campus of the College of Santa Fe, which still exists, apparently.
Thank goodness. That's great.
Thank goodness, especially...
Absolutely.
Especially for the sake of, I mean, among other things, the Santa Fe Art Institute.
All of the pieces, one evolves from the other, and I actually consider all of the work I've ever done one big piece, one big experiment, one big exploration. And I can see different elements in different pieces, whether they're video, or whether they're drawings, or whether they're sculpture, that they all interrelate. And they have, even though the concepts might vary, they still have this thread that goes all the way through them, for me. Because they all are based on each other.
It's funny, because it's hard to talk sometimes about visual art on the radio, but particularly in the case of your work, as I was looking at it, I was thinking, in a way, you want it to go into that nonverbal place in your mind and sit with it in a nonverbal manner and not try to explain everything away.
Well, absolutely. And it's always, you're always walking a fine line and you're on the tightrope when you're doing something like this interview, because perhaps then, if you're giving an interview or you're talking about it, maybe you should have just written about it instead of doing a visual.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's a... I'm trying to be as, you know, forthright as possible about it. But there are a lot of things that I don't know about it. And that's still, you know, and if I don't know, and I'm the and I'm speaking of, I'll look at it and go, that's it. I wonder why I did that particular, you know, why did I include that particular object? Or why is this looking that way or visually or whatever? Because I'm intrigued by that. And it...
Do you ever find that some art writer or art critic or art viewer will have an insight about that which is valuable to you?
Yes. Oh, absolutely. Just as many times as there'll be something that I would be completely wrong, I would think, that I would go, gosh, that's strange. I never intended that, or that wasn't my intention. I better go back and rethink that. Maybe I was... not clear enough, or maybe I don't know. You really can't pay attention to it.
To what people say about your work.
Yeah, I mean, otherwise you would just be, you know, you at least I would be stymied and I couldn't do anything. You just have to do what you feel is the correct thing for you to do at that particular time.
So you have this beautiful, nicely printed monograph about your work, which has been printed by the University of Texas Press. It just came out last year. What was your participation in putting it together? Did you get to have a lot of say in that?
I did, and I was very fortunate in that, and I wanted to be involved in doing the book. And I had a lot of input as to which images were in the book, because this is probably about a third of the work, maybe not even that much, a quarter of the work I've done. And my whole idea, and I think the designer and the press as well, I think they were equally interested in this, is that the book have a certain flow and a certain continuity and also a certain rhythm and interest to it. And so certain images were chosen for that reason. And so I was definitely involved in all of that. And to some extent, I was involved in the design of it, you know, choosing the image on the cover. There's some solid color pages, you know, picking that color. Right. And I enjoyed it. It was like making art.
Yeah, so I was going to say the book becomes a work of art, which some books about artists are and others are not.
Yeah, no, as much as possible, I wanted it to be that way.
Artist James Drake will be at the Santa Fe Art Institute's Tipton Hall tonight. Well, it's actually on the campus of the College of Santa Fe, but the talk is at 6 o'clock, sponsored by the Santa Fe Art Institute. You can find out more about them at sfai.org or call 505-424-5050. James Drake, thanks so much for being with us on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thanks a lot. It was fun. I enjoyed it.
We're going to take a break right now, and we'll be back in a moment. Please stay tuned to KSFR. I'm very happy now to welcome Billy Blair. She's the president of the Santa Fe Community Foundation. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
It's nice to be here, Mary Charlotte.
So tomorrow night, Tuesday, September 15th, at 6 o'clock at the Lenzic, is once again the award ceremony for the Pinion Awards.
That's right, and we like to call it the Academy Awards for the nonprofits.
Nice.
It's at 6 p.m. at the Lenzic, and we're honoring 5 nonprofits doing outstanding work in their areas. And those areas are arts, health and human services, education, the environment, and civic affairs.
And so you want to talk right now about some of the recipients of these?
Do you want me to tell you the winners? Do you want me to tell you the secret?
Well, it is on your website.
It is on our website? Gosh, you're too good a researcher. Well, I'm about to tell you. I would love to tell you. It's the Santa Fe Business Incubator, St. Elizabeth Shelter, Cooking with Kids, Rivers and Birds, and the Santa Fe International Folk Art Market.
So these are all very different organizations that really represent a spectrum of the type of activity that we have going on with many organizations here in Santa Fe.
They represent that spectrum, and they also represent the five funding areas of the Santa Fe Community Foundation. We hold endowments on behalf of the community that make grants in each of those areas. In fact, even as we're planning the Pinon Awards for tomorrow, we are in the process of doing site visits to determine what nonprofits get grants from earnings on the community's endowments.
So the Santa Fe Community Foundation, and we'll go back to the specific recipients of the Pinon Awards in a few moments, but the Santa Fe Community Foundation has something which is very unusual, which is an endowment, the proceeds of which, or what do you call it, the revenues of which, the earnings of which, thank you, go to various organizations that apply.
Exactly. And you might say, in this environment, you might say, well, Billy, how can there be earnings?
Yeah, that is a good question, isn't it?
With last year being the way it was. And actually, last year, we did have a negative return. I think most everybody saw that in his or her portfolio.
Yes.
And we certainly did in the community's portfolio. But the way we do our grant making is over a 12-quarter rolling average. So that really means that it smooths out the peaks and valleys in the market.
That is so smart.
Yes.
It averages over 3 years.
That's right. And so when we make our grants, our grant making is only going to be $20,000 less than it was the year before.
Very interesting. And so people apply in these different areas, for example, health and human services, the environment, education, civic affairs, and arts. Let's talk about health and human services. What kind of needs, what kind of problems are you seeing in Santa Fe in that particular area?
The health and human services problems are just run the gamut. I mean, it's everything from feeding the hungry and sheltering the homeless to people providing services to individuals like the Rape Crisis Center, like Esperanza, like youth shelters. There are so many needs, and all of these organizations now need funding more than ever before. So we encourage individual donors to give directly to those organizations, or they can give to the Health and Human Services Endowment at the Community Foundation and know that their earnings are going to be supporting that work in perpetuity.
So that's the advantage of giving to the Community Foundation instead of giving directly, because you're giving to an endowment that, in theory, keeps on earning money.
It is. And, you know, the other example is we have more than 70 endowments that we have on behalf of nonprofits. So there are nonprofits like anything from the Wild Earth Guardians is going to be on your show sometime soon.
Tomorrow.
And Think New Mexico, who have... And these organizations have endowments with us because that's our business, is managing money and also helping them get planned gifts, get people to give a gift at the end of their lifetime to those organizations. And that's another way that those nonprofits can be assured that their work goes on in perpetuity.
So health and human services is one. The environment is another. Again, you're talking about really pretty localized giving for, well, resource management, air, land, water, things like that.
Yes, and, you know, we fund in six northern New Mexico counties, primarily in Santa Fe, but also in Los Alamos, Rio Riba, Mora, San Miguel, and Taos.
And so this year, Rivers and Birds is the recipient for that.
And it's from Taos, and it's such a wonderful organization. Have you ever spoken with them?
No. I've heard of them.
And we just saw the video last week that will be shown at the Pinon Awards, and it's really so inspiring. They work with fifth graders, largely in Taos, and they show them how land and water interconnect. They take them out to meet mayordomos to learn about, you know, the sources of water. I just heard a story about a young girl who was homeschooled, and she got introduced to Rivers and Birds, and she started giving them money and raising money for them to plant trees along the Rio Grande. Over the years, this child, who I believe is 10 years old, has raised $3,000 for Rivers and Birds.
Amazing.
So you can see there's a lot of community support in Taos for this particular program.
And fifth grade, that's such a ripe age for
budding intellects and activists and just active young people.
It's a great age to catch these children and teach them about environmental responsibility.
So another area that you are doing is education. Who was the recipient this year for that? Oh, Cooking with Kids.
Cooking with Kids, and we're all familiar with the Cooking with Kids program, I think.
Well, what if we're not?
What if we're not?
What do they do?
Cooking with Kids has been around since 1995. They work in the public schools. They have a fabulous program in which they introduce children to healthy food choices and also international foods. They go in and they actually make, the children make meals, and they are learning geography at the same time. They might make a meal that's from somewhere in Africa, or they might make a meal that's from France. Would you rather have that, the rich French food?
I can work with that,
you
yes.
You can work
thank
with
you
that.
Very much.
They've also done some really good work in bringing farmers and ranchers in northern New Mexico into the classroom so children understand that milk comes from cows and not from those boxes in the grocery store.
Right, right. And that there are other choices besides Frito pie and M&Ms.
Exactly. And they've also gotten some of the school cafeterias to change their menus somewhat to feed our children healthier food in school.
So this is a theme, getting kids really revved up at an early age and getting them to change even the adult world around them.
That's right. You see two winners in that area this year.
We didn't talk about, when we were talking about health and human services, we didn't talk about St. Elizabeth's Shelter.
We didn't. And, you know, St. Elizabeth's Shelter, the good thing about St. Elizabeth's Shelter, a lot of people think of it as only the building over on Isla Reed Street, but they also have transitional living. They have a place called Casa Cerrillos, which is out Cerrillos Road behind Country Dan's Furniture. They have a place in Tierra Contenta, which is for families. And they do a lot of work not only bringing in the homeless, but helping them, counseling them, giving them job training so that they can eventually have real housing of their own.
It is quite amazing how easy it is to become homeless, even for somebody who is working. I got a call from an acquaintance not long ago who had a bad incident in the house where they were living, and suddenly they did not have a place to live. And this is a person with a job who didn't have enough money to put a down payment on a new apartment.
It's amazing. We heard about a man who had been a draftsman, and he lost his job in this economy, and suddenly he couldn't afford to pay his rent. And he stayed with friends for a while, and you can only do that for so long.
Couch surfing.
He was not an older man, a man, I guess, in his 40s. And he ended up at St. Elizabeth's Shelter. Now, though, he has been retrained, is doing another job, and is actually at work, but no longer as a draftsman.
St. Elizabeth Shelter is one of the recipients of the Pinion Awards. We're talking to President of the Santa Fe Community Foundation, Billy Blair. And tomorrow night, the Pinion Awards will be given at 6 o'clock. It's a free event at the Lensic.
That's right.
So the Santa Fe Business Incubator, that's another area that you cover, and that's civic affairs is another category in which you give grants.
It's another category, and the Business Incubator is now in its 11th year. It celebrated its first decade last year, and in that time, they have incubated successfully 70 businesses and created some 700 jobs. And half of those businesses have been woman-owned or minority-owned.
And that's very purposeful on their part.
That is purposeful, is they really try to build our economy by training people, giving them the tools to use to become successful business people. And once you're successful and you start at their site, which is over on Airport Road, but once you're successful, they kick you out.
Right.
It's like a mama bird. They kick you out of the nest.
Of the nest.
Yeah.
That's interesting. My tax person used to be in that building, and now she's not. I guess she did well enough to have to leave.
She's successful then.
And so the Business Incubator, they give them, what do? They give them space and guidance.
Space, they give them technical assistance, which is advice. They give them some bookkeeping services. They have shared office space, so shared resources. You can use a shared copier and that type of thing.
So they are another recipient of the Pinion Award. And the final one is the Santa Fe International Folk Market, and that's in the category of the arts.
And you know, this is pretty much a brand new nonprofit. I'm gonna.
What are we in the third year? Did we just finish the third year?
We finished the third year of the International Folk Market, and what they've done is they've done a tremendous job of creating commerce for artists worldwide and bringing artists here to sell their folk art up on Museum Hill in the summer. The reason they're getting the award for the Community Foundation, though, is that they've also, in the last year, done a great job of engaging the community. They have a passport program for children, so children can go around with this passport, visit various craftspeople, and have their passport stamped, that they've been to China, that they've been to Guatemala,
nice.
You know, wherever those places are. So they've really started doing outreach to the community, which is something we value at the Community Foundation.
In the folk art market, and we've talked to them a little bit on this program, the artists actually and artisans show up from their countries, and there are scholarships if they can't afford sometimes to come. Some of them are actually paid for. They sell what they sell, and then they get to bring home, what, almost everything that they earn.
They get to bring home everything they earn. I think this last year the number was $14,000 per artist, which may not sound like much to us here in the rich country of the United States of America, but it's an awful lot when you're from a third world country.
Yeah, you could live for, depending on where you live, you could live for a long time, feed your family, or do, and this is another aspect of it, improvements to the community and the place where you come from.
Exactly.
So those are the recipients of the Pinion Awards that are being given out tomorrow night at the Lenzic. Tuesday, September 15th. And the Santa Fe Community Foundation is grant-making. You have an endowment, but you're always having to build that endowment further.
We are, and individuals are very good at giving gifts to those endowments. We have a new endowment building campaign that's ongoing right now, which is called the Circle of Care for the Arts. We did this, you might remember, a number of years ago in Health and Human Services. We raised $1 million to add to our Health and Human Services endowment. Now we seek to raise $1 million for the arts. And in the arts, we fund arts for children and to make arts available to people otherwise would not have that experience. So, for example, if somebody's already funding the symphony or the opera or some major arts organization, this is not the same thing. What we're doing is totally different with the earnings from this fund. We have 41 members at this time. We need 59 more to complete that circle. I was always struck by a comment that was made by Dana Jowell, who was the former head of the National Endowment for the Arts. And he said that the single thing that shows whether people are going to be civically engaged is not what college you went to or what neighborhood you grew up in, but whether people read for pleasure and experience the arts.
Really?
So it's our goal that every Santa Fean who wants to experience the arts, either child or person who otherwise could not afford it, be it dance, be it theater, be it the fine arts, have that opportunity.
Very, very interesting. You invest this money. How do you decide who to invest it with?
Well, thank goodness I do not have to make that decision. We have a very skilled and talented finance committee, and we have an asset allocation strategy that is designed for the long run for the foundation. And we have funds in equities, in fixed income or bonds, and funds in cash, and funds in alternative investments.
I was wondering if the people who are in charge of investing make sure, for example, that you're not investing in the kinds of companies that make people homeless in the first place or put small businesses out of business.
I think they're paying attention to that, but they're also paying attention to, they're really keeping a close eye on those investments, how the investment managers are doing. Because remember, we're doing that on behalf of the community. We're doing that on behalf of the 70 nonprofits we have endowments for. And we're doing it on behalf of individuals or families who have donor advised funds with us. So they have something like a mini foundation in which they can put the money at their community foundation, and we manage those funds, and then they recommend to us what organizations should get the grants.
Now, do people who give money, do they say, oh, I want to give it specifically for environmental causes, or do they just give to the community foundation and then you put it where it's most needed?
People do different things. Some people know exactly what they want to give to. Many donor advisors know exactly what they want to fund. Many others want recommendations. They want to say, I'm interested in the environment. Tell me groups that are doing good work there. Or I'm interested in helping children with a certain need. Tell me groups that are doing good work there. And some people, let me just mention this, the Maloof family, the Mike and Dee Maloof family, gave us $250,000 challenge grant to raise funds that are basically unrestricted. And they're called opportunity funds because they are, in fact, our opportunity to meet future unknown needs. When somebody gives funds that are going to be used 50 years from now, 100 years from now, we don't know what those needs are going to be.
Right.
I don't think you and I can sit here today and even envision.
Not even the beginning of a clue. It sort of depends a lot on climate change.
Yes, and many things. So with the opportunity funds, we're trying to match that $250,000 dollar for dollar with gifts. Every dollar that people give counts toward that match. Or people can open a fund, name it for themselves. My husband and I have done that for only $10,000.
You are not only the president of the Santa Fe Community Foundation, but you are also a donor to the foundation.
I was a donor first.
Yeah. And I think that's very important because that everybody who is part of something is also, you know, and like if they think the way you do, they're committed to it from their pocketbook as well.
I was attracted, Mary Charlotte, to the Community Foundation when I first arrived in Santa Fe in 1990 from Taos. And a wonderful man named Al Wadle, who has Wadle Galleries on Palace Avenue, approached me, took me to lunch, told me about the Community Foundation, told me about the Circle of Care for Health and Human Services. I was so touched and captivated by his spirit and his enthusiasm that I couldn't help but join and be a donor to the foundation. And also be committed to the foundation, first in that way, then as a board member, and now as its CEO.
So you are going to leave the foundation soon and reinvent yourself and do some other things.
On January 15th of 2010, which is still a while away, and it has a certain symmetry to it because our fiscal year ends on January 10, and it does give me a chance to decide how I'd like to repot myself.
And so you will be just taking some time off and enjoying Santa Fe, among other things.
And listening to your show.
Well, Billy Blair, it's wonderful to have you on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. Billy Blair is president of the Santa Fe Community Foundation. And once again, the Pinion Awards will be tomorrow, September 15th, at 6 o'clock at the Lenzic Theater here on Santa Fe on San Francisco Street, right off of the plaza. It's a free event. If anybody wants to go to your website, what is it?
It's Santa Fe, C as in community, F as in foundation.org. And I want to add one more thing. I forgot to say about those awards tomorrow. Because we just did a rehearsal today, Wise Fool is our entertainment.
Nice.
And it is going to be so joyful. So it's 1 hour. People are really missing out if they don't come to the Lenzic at 6 o'clock tomorrow.
What are they going to do, the trapeze and the...
I'm not telling you. There's a big surprise.
Okay. Billy Blair, thank you so much for being with us on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org. We are podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's very wonderful dot foil computer services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes, and you can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, the Colors of Jazz.